The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Known for placing his reader's hand on the heart of human experience, Jonathan Safran Foer is the best-selling author of the humorously irreverent, emotionally urgent novels Everything is Illuminated, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, and Here I Am. His nonfiction investigation into the carnivorous human condition that he first discussed in his bestseller, Eating Animals, continues with his latest work, We Are the Weather, a moving personal story that is also a cogent argument to sacrifice current comfort for the sake of humanity's future, one that begins with what we collectively eat and don't eat at breakfast. Please welcome Jonathan Safran Foer.
Hello. Thank you for coming. I really love coming back to the Free Library here. This was one of the first readings I ever did. It was in this room, and that was now, how long ago was that, Andy? 17 years ago. Yeah. And I was really so young then. And I say that not as a joke. In a way, the whole point of my being here, the whole point as I understood it, was that I was young. It was what was like talked about. It was the way the book was talked about. And since then, I've probably come back 4 or 5 times. And it's always the same. I meet Andy in the lobby, and then we go back to the green room, and we talk for a while. And I was just saying to him as we were back there, I don't have great ways, I mean, most people don't have great ways of measuring progress in life. Progress maybe isn't the right word, just measuring the passage of time. And I really value something, it's an unexpected thing to have happened. When I decided to become a writer, I never thought that these occasions of returning to places periodically and having these catch-up conversations with the same people would be a way to take stock. And, you know, we talked about everything back there, from the fact that his youngest is now in college. My oldest, who was nowhere near being born, when I did my first reading here, just had his bar mitzvah this year. And it's just a very, very special thing. And I doubt that it's a coincidence that I've chosen to change the way that I write over time. I doubt that that was uninfluenced by these meetings, these kinds of taking stocks. It's, I mean, a book itself is a little bit like that, like an occasion to just create a time and space to think about things, to reflect, in much the same way that maybe a birthday or New Year's Eve is in a smaller scale. So it's, all of which is to say, I'm very, very happy to be back. This is the first reading that I'm doing from this book in America. I was in the Netherlands and Italy for a couple of weeks before. But this is the way that these subjects are thought about in America is quite different than the way that they're thought about in Europe, or at least that's my impression. We'll maybe find out a little bit as we talk after I do the reading. Even though this is the first event that I've done some interviews, some radio interviews, podcasts, print interviews. There are fewer and fewer places to do print interviews now than there have ever been before, or at least that's my experience. And, you know, podcasts are on the ascent. And one of the podcasts that I did was with a guy named Ben Shapiro. Does anybody know who that is? He's a far right-wing public intellectual, and he has a lot of views that I don't hold and that make me extremely uncomfortable. But the prospect of getting to talk to him, he's a really smart guy, you know, putting aside some of his opinions. He's obviously a very, very smart, articulate guy, and he has a huge audience. And if we are going to be serious about talking about climate change, we have to talk to everybody. There's no hope if we're only talking to half or a third of the population. So I thought this could be really productive. It could be interesting. I was also quite nervous before going on because he's good at pinning people rhetorically. And climate change is a subject that often degenerates into rhetoric, into people cherry-picking facts and pointing out small hypocrisies. And I didn't want to be in that position, so I made sure that I memorized all of my data and got all of my arguments sound. And I went through interviews he had done with other people to see how he trapped them. And so I went to LA, and I sat down across from him, and we started talking. And he said, so what is, you know, climate change? What is it you want to talk about here? What do you want to talk about climate change? And I said, well, why don't we start by you tell me what your definition of climate change is? And I really had no idea what he was going to say at all. And he said, well, climate change is a description of this process that we're now living through, where in the next century, the Earth will warm between 2 and 6 degrees centigrade because of human activity. And I thought, wow, that's a really solid description of climate change. That's pretty similar to what I would have said. And I thought that this person, who is the sort of epitome of the far right in America, is actually not a climate change denier, not in the sense of denying the science of climate change. As it turns out, there really aren't that many climate change deniers anymore. Twice as many Americans believe in the existence of Bigfoot as deny the existence of climate change. 91% of Americans accept the science of climate change. 70% of Americans, including the majority of Republicans, said that they wished the United States had remained in the Paris Climate Accords. So I think there's a kind of misunderstanding or a misimpression that a lot of us have that the country is evenly split, and that if we could just convince these stupid, ignorant people to believe in the science, then we would be saved. And it's possible that the president is in this very select club of stupid, ignorant people, but not that many others are. And I think that we are misdirecting our energy when we talk about them and when we think about them too much, when we get angry at them. You know, if you want to wake up somebody who's asleep, it's pretty easy. You just poke them really hard on the shoulder or you pinch their nose closed. But if you try to wake up somebody who's pretending to be asleep, it's impossible. And the remaining climate change deniers are pretending to be asleep. It's a willful kind of ignorance, and it's really not important, and it shouldn't be our focus. But there are a lot of kinds of denial, not just denial of science, but the kind of denial that I practice, and my guess is everybody in this room practices, which is acknowledging that we are in this situation and caring about the situation, but not acting as if we care about the situation. So, you know, politically, the goalposts have moved over the last 5 or 10 years. It was the case, let's say 10 years ago, even 5 years ago, that a large number of people denied the science of climate change. And then it started to shift to, okay, the Earth is warming, but not necessarily because of human activity. And there are very, very few people who believe that anymore. And now it's shifted to, it's happening because of human activity. We don't know exactly how bad it's going to be. Let's wait a little while. Let's just wait and see. And in the meantime, technology is going to get all that much better. We're going to figure out ways to adapt with whatever it is that happens. So that might describe Ben Shapiro's version of denial. I think it accurately does. My version of denial is a little bit different, which is like really fervently believing in, emotionally believing in the reality of the situation and the urgency of the situation, but doing almost nothing about it. And my guess is that my carbon footprint is significantly worse than the average denier of the science of climate change. But I've soothed myself by saying the things that are that feel good to say, you know, at dinner parties or in situations like this, and to friends, and I have the right bumper stickers, and I wear the right t-shirts, and I would be the first to attend a march. But the question is, are those actions actions? You know, are they actually changing our situation? So I thought that I would start by reading a passage about this problem of the difference between knowing something and believing it. And this is rather near the beginning of the book. I think it's the second or third chapter. In 1942, a 28-year-old Catholic in the Polish underground, Jan Karski, embarked on a mission to travel from Nazi-occupied Poland to London and ultimately America to inform world leaders of what the Germans were perpetrating. In anticipation of his journey, he met with several resistance groups, accumulating information and testimonies to bring to the West. In his memoir, he recounts a meeting with the head of the Jewish Socialist Alliance, and I'll just quote from his recounting. The Bund leader came up to me in silence. He gripped my arm with such violence that it ached. I looked into his wild, staring eyes, moved by the deep, unbearable pain in them. Tell the Jewish leaders that this is no case for politics or tactics. Tell them that the earth must be shaken to its foundations. The world must be aroused. Perhaps then it will wake up, understand, and perceive. Tell them that they must find the strength and courage to make sacrifices no other statesmen have ever had to make, sacrifices as painful as the fate of my dying people and as unique. This is what they don't understand. German aims and methods are without precedent in history. The democracies must react in a way that is also without precedent, choose unheard of methods as an answer. After surviving as perilous a journey as could be imagined, Karski arrived in Washington, D.C. in June of 1943. There, he met with Supreme Court Justice Felix Frankfurter, one of the great legal minds in American history, and himself a Jew. After hearing Karski's accounts of the clearing of the Warsaw Ghetto and of exterminations in the concentration camps, after asking him a series of increasingly specific questions, like, what's the height of the wall that separates the ghetto from the rest of the city? Frankfurter paced the room in silence, then took his seat and said, Mr. Karski, a man like me talking to a man like you must be totally frank. So I must say, I am unable to believe what you told me. When Karski's colleague pleaded with Frankfurter to accept Karski's account, Frankfurter responded, I didn't say that this young man is lying. I said that I am unable to believe him. My mind and my heart, they are made in such a way that I cannot accept it. Frankfurter didn't question the truthfulness of Karski's story. He didn't dispute that the Germans were systematically murdering the Jews of Europe, his own relatives. And he didn't respond that while he was persuaded and horrified, there was nothing he could do. Rather, he admitted not only his inability to believe the truth, but his awareness of that inability. Our minds and hearts are well built to perform certain tasks and poorly designed for others. We are good at things like calculating the path of a hurricane and bad at things like deciding to get out of its way. Because we evolved over hundreds of millions of years in settings that bear little resemblance to the modern world, we're often led to desires, fears, and differences that neither correspond nor respond to modern realities. We are disproportionately drawn to immediate and local needs. We crave fats and sugars, which are bad for people who live in a world of their ready availability. We hypervigilantly watch our children on jungle gyms, despite the many greater risks to their health that we ignore, while remaining indifferent to what is lethal, but over there. Although many of climate change's accompanying calamities, like extreme weather events, floods, and wildfires, displacement, and resource scarcity, are vivid, personal, and suggestive of a worsening situation, they just don't feel that way in aggregate. They feel abstract, distant, and isolated, rather than like beams of an ever-strengthening narrative. As the journalist Oliver Berkerman put it in The Guardian, if a cabal of evil psychologists had gathered in a secret undersea base to concoct a crisis that humanity would be hopelessly ill-equipped to address, they couldn't have done better than climate change. So-called climate change deniers reject the conclusion that 97% of climate scientists have reached. The planet is warming because of human activity. But what about those of us who say that we accept the reality of human-caused climate change? We may not think that the scientists are lying, but are we capable of believing what they tell us? Such a belief would surely awaken us to the urgent ethical imperative attached to it, shake our collective conscience, and render us willing to make small sacrifices in the present to avoid cataclysmic ones in the future. Intellectually accepting the truth isn't virtuous in and of itself, and it won't save us. As a child, I was often told, "You know better," when I did something that I shouldn't have done. Knowing was the difference between a mistake and an offense. If we accept a factual reality that we're destroying the planet, but are unable to believe it, then we are no better than those who deny the existence of human-caused climate change, just as Felix Frankfurter was no better than those who denied the existence of the Holocaust. And when the future distinguishes between these two kinds of denial, which will appear to be a grave error and which an unforgivable crime? So people often ask me, why did I decide to write this book? You know, I am a novelist, and what moved me, or what was the moment of inspiration? There's an old saying, or maybe it's even a joke, that once upon a time there was a person whose life was so good there's no story to tell about it. Stories are always born out of a problem or a discomfort. And I felt an extreme discomfort, a growing and then extreme discomfort, about my relationship to climate change. I heard myself saying more and more often this sentence that you have maybe heard yourself saying in the past couple of years, which is, we have to do something, or someone has to do something. Maybe you said it about the family separations at the border. Maybe you said it after another mass shooting, or maybe after witnessing images of the evidence of climate change, like the burning of the Amazon, or a melting ice sheet, or climate refugees, or record temperatures, whatever it is. The we was never including me. I didn't bother to investigate what it was that I could do, if there was anything that I could do that would matter. So my best way to deal with intolerable thoughts like that is to try to write about it, because that's how I am slow and deliberate and careful. So I started to do a little bit of research, and what I found was that there's a very, very broad consensus about what it is that we can do as individuals, and it doesn't really conform to what most of us think. You know, most of us think that if we recycle, that's a really powerful act. That if we refuse to use plastic straws, that's a really powerful act. That if we buy hybrid cars, that's a really powerful act. In fact, there are four things that matter significantly more than all others, which are eating a plant-based diet, which is to say eating as few animal products, meat and dairy, as possible, flying as little as possible, living car-free rather than having a hybrid, and having fewer children. So most people are not in the process of deciding whether or not to have more children in a given moment. My casual guess from perusing this audience is that most people in this room are not in the process of deciding whether or not to have more children in this given moment. 85% of Americans drive to work, and most American cities were built in such a way that cars are effectively required. More than half of the flights that we take are either for business or for non-leisure personal purposes, like visiting a sick relative. So we have to somehow control the population, we have to fly less, and we have to drive less, but those are complicated. They're not easy. It's not as simple as saying, just do those things and then everybody will go home and do those things. But eating is a little bit different because it's an opportunity that we have three times a day and it's really unconstrained. Nobody forces us to eat one way or another. And we know, and this is not my opinion, it's not an argument that I'm making, I'm just sharing established fact, that animal agriculture is either the leading cause or the number two cause of greenhouse gas emissions. We know that it's the leading cause of methane and nitrous oxide emissions, which are the two most powerful greenhouse gases. We know that it's the leading cause of deforestation. 91% of the burning in the Amazon is for the sole purpose of creating room for livestock to graze or creating room to grow crops for the livestock. So this is a place where we can make a change. Eating differently is not going to save the planet. But as the IPCC recently reported, this was about a month ago, and the IPCC is now sort of the gold standard for climate science, and a relatively conservative scientific body as well, said that we have no hope of saving the planet, even if we were to do everything else, if we don't eat less meat. Now, that having been said, it's not the easiest thing in the world to do. I'm a vegetarian, but I don't find it effortless to be a vegetarian. I'm not the kind of vegetarian who finds meat to be disgusting. I'm not the kind of vegetarian who goes in for slogans like meat is murder. The truth is, although meat is murder, but the truth is, you know, oftentimes when I'm looking at somebody across the table from me eating meat, I wish I were eating what they were eating. Like, it smells good to me, it looks good to me. And I have many, many, many positive associations with meat. When I see chicken, I often think about the chicken that my grandmother would make for me and my brothers when we were kids. When I see burgers, I often think about the burgers that my dad would grill on July 4th. When I see salmon, I often think of the smoked salmon that my mom would bring home for like a special weekend bagel treat. And it's just not simple to extricate oneself from all of those memories and all of that history. It's not as easy as just knowing that it's the right thing to do. And when I say right, I don't mean by anybody else's judgment. I mean by our own judgment. Like, these are shared values. Certainly everybody in this room is concerned about the environment. Everybody in this room cares about the quality of air we breathe, the water we drink, how many species are going to go extinct, how many days kids will be able to spend outside in the summers. These aren't Democrat or Republican or urban or rural or old or young or religious or secular values. They're just fundamental human values. But it can still be tricky to act on those values. So it's easy to understate the challenge. It's also easy to overstate the challenge, especially when considering the crisis that we're not only facing but are already experiencing. So I wanted to read one more passage, and this is from yet earlier in the book, and it's about home front efforts during World War II. During World War II, citizens in American cities along the East Coast turned off their lights at dusk. They weren't themselves in imminent danger. The purpose of the blackout was to prevent German U-boats from using urban backlighting to spot and destroy ships exiting harbor. As the war progressed, blackouts were practiced in cities across the country, even those far from the coast, to immerse civilians in a conflict whose horrors were out of sight, but whose victory would require collective action. On the home front, civilians needed a reminder that life as they knew it could be destroyed. And darkness was one way to illuminate that threat. Civil air patrol pilots were encouraged to comb the skies above the Midwest for enemy aircraft, despite the fact that no German fighter plane of the era was capable of flying that far. Solidarity was an important asset, even if such gestures would have been foolish, would have been suicidal, if they were the only efforts made. World War II would not have been won without home front actions that had both psychological and tangible impacts. ordinary people joining together to support the greater cause. During the war, industrial productivity rose by 96%. Liberty ships that took 8 months to construct at the start of the war were completed in weeks. By 1942, companies that had once manufactured cars, refrigerators, metal office furniture, and washing machines now produced military products. Lingerie factories began making camouflage netting. Adding machines were reborn as pistols, and the lung-like bags of vacuum cleaners were transplanted into the bodies of gas masks. Retirees, women, and students entered the workforce. Many states changed their labor laws to allow teenagers to work. Everyday commodities like rubber, tin cans, aluminum foil, and lumber were collected for reuse in the war effort. Congress enlarged the tax base by lowering the minimum taxable income and reducing personal exemptions and deductions. In 1940, 10% of American workers paid federal income tax. By 1944, the number approached 100%. Top marginal tax rates were raised to 94%, while the income that qualified for that rate was reduced by 25-fold. The government enacted, and Americans accepted, price controls on nylon, bicycles, shoes, firewood, silk, and coal. Gasoline was severely regulated, and a speed limit of 35 miles per hour was imposed nationally to reduce gas and rubber consumption. U.S. government posters advocating carpooling declared, "When you ride alone, you ride with Hitler." On the evening of April 28, 1942, 5 months after the bombing of Pearl Harbor and well into the war effort in Europe, millions of Americans gathered around their radios to listen to President Roosevelt's fireside chat, in which he gave an update on the state of the war and spoke about the challenges ahead, including what would be asked of citizens. So now I'll read just a tiny passage from this speech, and just imagine if any of our leaders would speak to us in this way. And I don't mean Trump, I mean any of our leaders. "Not all of us have the privilege of fighting our enemies in distant parts of the world. Not all of us can have the privilege of working in a munitions factory or a shipyard or on the farms or in oil fields or mines producing the weapons or the raw materials that are needed by our armed forces. But there's one front and one battle where everyone in the United States, every man, woman, and child, is in action and will be privileged to remain in action throughout the war. That front is right here at home, in our daily lives, and in our daily tasks. Here at home, everyone will have the privilege of making whatever self-denial is necessary, not only to supply our fighting men, but to keep the economic structure of our country fortified and secure during the war and after the war. This will require, of course, the abandonment not only of luxuries, but of many other creature comforts. Every loyal American is aware of his individual responsibility. As I told the Congress yesterday, sacrifice is not exactly the proper word with which to describe this program of self-denial. When, at the end of this great struggle, we shall have saved our free way of life, we shall have made no sacrifice." It's an extreme burden to be required to give the government 94% of your income. It's a significant challenge to have one's food staples rationed. It's a frustrating inconvenience to be able to drive no faster than 35 miles per hour. It's slightly annoying to have to turn off the lights at night. Despite many Americans' perception of the war as over there, a little darkness seemed reasonable to ask of citizens who were, after all, largely safe and secure over here. How would we regard someone who, in the middle of a great struggle to save not only millions of lives, but our free way of life, deemed turning off his lights too much of a sacrifice? Of course, the war couldn't have been won only with that collective act. Victory required 16 million Americans to serve in the military, more than $4 trillion, and the armed forces of more than a dozen other countries. But imagine if the war couldn't have been won without it. Imagine if preventing Nazi flags from flying in London, Moscow, and Washington, D.C. required the nightly flipping of switches. Imagine if the remaining 10.5 million Jews of the world could not have been saved without those hours of darkness. How then would we regard the self-denial of citizens? We shall have made no sacrifice. So I just want to end this part, and then we'll open up to questions by telling you a story of something that happened to me when I was in Brussels. I was doing a reading just last week, and after the reading, there was a signing, and a young couple came up and passed me their book to sign, and they opened to the title page, which is usually empty except for the title, and it was filled with their handwriting. And I said, "What's this?" And they said, "Well, we're getting married in a month, and we decided that if we don't have a plan for how we're going to live our lives, we're just going to keep living as we've always lived." And they showed me their plan, and it said, "We won't eat meat unless it's served to us at a friend's house. We will be vegan 2 days a week. We won't have more than 2 children, and we will not drive more than 1,500 kilometers a year." And I was really... Oh, and then the other thing is, they had a line that said witness, and that's where they wanted me to sign. And I was really moved. Really, really, really moved. I was moved by the differences between their plan and what I propose in this book, which I haven't even mentioned yet, which is to refrain from eating animal products for breakfast and lunch, and then eat the dinner that you would normally eat. That's based on the most comprehensive analysis of the connection between food and global warming, which was published at the end of last year in Nature magazine, which said that while people who live in malnourished, poor parts of the world can afford to eat a little bit more meat and a little bit more dairy, people who live in America, people who live in the United Kingdom, people who live in Europe have to reduce their meat consumption by 90% and their dairy consumption by 60% if we are going to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accords. So I thought a relatively easy way to sort of approach those numbers is to think about eliminating these things from breakfast and lunch. So their plan was different than what I proposed in my book. And I realized I didn't have a plan. It wasn't until they showed me their plan that I realized I don't have a plan. I go around saying, like, yeah, I'm going to do better. Yeah, I'm going to try to do that. I'm going to try to fly less. People who try to fly less fly the same amount they always fly. People who try to eat differently eat the same way they've always eaten. People who codify their beliefs and say, this is what I'm going to do, and people who have witnesses, you know, whether they're friends or family members, are much more likely to change. And it was then, this is just a week and a half ago, that I started talking to my kids about, guys, I'm going to try to eat a little bit differently at breakfast and lunch. Here's what I'm going to do. And I want us to fly differently. And what I said was that in 2020, we're not going to fly on any vacations. Every vacation we take, we will use a train. It becomes really different when it's spoken aloud, and it becomes especially different when it's spoken to somebody that you care about, because, you know, it's the power of a friend or a partner, it's the power of a witness, as they keep you honest, and it's very hard to betray something that you, a goal that you have spoken aloud, especially one for reasons like this, for, you know, deep values-based reasons. And that's really changed me. That couple really, really changed me. So I would invite everybody here who cares about the planet, which is just to say everybody here, to formulate a plan and write it down and share it with somebody. We don't have to all have the same plan. We won't all have the same plan. And the differences between our plans will probably be even more inspiring than the overlaps in our plans. But if we were capable of doing that, we would live in a very different culture. And those plans, you know, wouldn't, like eating differently, they wouldn't save the world. But I don't think we have any chance of saving the world without having these very individual plans. So Andy handed me his watch and said, to talk for about this amount of time, he said, and this was a testimony to how many times we've now met and how much time has passed, he said, you might have to squint to see what the watch says. And I said, oh, that's not my problem. My problem is hearing. So I would have a hard time hearing it, but of course that's not necessary with a watch. But we each fall apart in our own ways. So all of that having been said, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have, to I'm always eager to hear people's own experiences, whatever it is you want to talk about.
Thanks for coming. Thanks for writing the book. I just missed a step in the logic, and I apologize for the sort of small nature of the question. I understand the reasons for not eating red meat and drinking milk, for the deforestation, the methane, and all of that. I didn't understand why not to eat chicken or eggs or salmon.
So he was asking about different foods and their different carbon footprints. We're absolutely right that not, I mean, your implication is right, that not all foods are as bad as all other foods. So beef and cheese are significantly worse than other kinds of foods. Somebody who is a vegan for two meals a day has a smaller carbon footprint than somebody who's a vegetarian for the entire day because of the carbon footprint of cheese. And chicken is far less bad than beef and cheese and pork, and then chicken and then fish is further down the line. These other foods, I should say, their carbon footprints might not compete, but there are plenty of other good reasons to try to eat as little of them as possible, like the overfishing of the oceans, the fact that it's estimated that we won't have any wild fish at all in our oceans in about 20 years, the existence of ocean dead zones, the fact that the amount of water pollution that's being created, and the animal cruelty, you know, which is something that can sometimes be a little, I find a little tricky to talk about. A lot of these issues, I find, I don't know about you, I find it sometimes embarrassing to share my values. Like when I'm at, you know, when I was in Europe doing these readings, I would go out to dinner with my publisher and there'd be like 12 people at the table and we'd have a vegetarian dinner, obviously. And yet sometimes I felt the need to apologize or to make a joke about it. And similarly, when I talk about animal welfare, you know, climate change is something where it's just, in this political moment, nobody is going to be willing to stand up and say, don't be ridiculous, you know? But animal welfare is one of those things where there are some number of people who might not stand up and say it, but feel it, despite it being something that virtually all Americans agree on. 96% of Americans think that animals deserve protection from cruelty, farmed animals, and 70% of Americans say that they're willing to pay more for food if they simply know that the animal is treated better. That having been said, I sometimes find a reflexive embarrassment when I talk about it, or like a need to apologize, to say things like, and if you care about animal welfare, but of course everybody should. You know, why wouldn't you? There's nothing to be embarrassed about. I am convinced that our ancestors, our descendants, excuse me, will look back at the way we eat in the same way that we look back at other historic crimes and say, how could they have done that? How could they have done? How could humans have done that? How could they ever have done that? Raised animals in cages so small they can't turn around. In ways that, you know, required antibiotics to keep these animals alive. They required slaughtering them when they were in their adolescence, lest their body weight crush their skeletal structures. I'm pretty sure my grandchildren, if not my children, will look back and say, boy, oh boy, oh boy, did they have a ethical blind spot. In any case, the argument against eating meat in our world, not in a hypothetical world in which animals are raised on the kinds of farms that they were 100 years ago, but in our world of 7+ billion people, where 99.9% of the animals eaten in America come from factory farms, is just a bad thing. And bad for the environment, bad for our health, bad for farmers, bad for rural communities, bad for animals. And the less we do of it, the better. But that doesn't require us to completely abstain, you know? Like, there are options other than vegan and like kind of pure carnivore. We've gotten into the habit of maybe because the situation makes us feel vulnerable, like I was saying about my own embarrassment, people who feel vulnerable tend to move to extremes and binaries. kind of like almost like an intellectual fight or flight instinct. It's the same thing with climate change. You know, some very smart people talk about climate change like it's a doomsday apocalypse that's imminent, which it's not. You know, I am as concerned as those people, but that's not in keeping with the science. In the same way that saying we're going to be fine is not in keeping with the science. The truth is we're not doomed and we're not going to be fine. We're at the near the beginning of a process of really profound loss, and some of that loss has already been determined, but most of it hasn't, and it will be determined by the choices that we make. So to say we are doomed or we are going to be fine is to excuse oneself from participating in that process of contributing to a world where there's less loss rather than more loss. Anyway, different foods. There's actually a page in this book that explicitly shows the carbon footprint of each of the kinds of foods that you were just mentioning. And if you were to say, hey, I want to continue to eat animal products, but I'm very concerned about the environment, I would say, oh, well, then it's definitely better to eat fish and chicken than it is to eat beef and cheese.
I have a suggestion and a question. The suggestion is that you join me in writing to your politicians in Washington for a 50 cent per gallon increase in the gasoline tax. That would provide the government with more money for education and good causes, and it would also provide an incentive to drive less. My question is, did you and Ben Shapiro, were you able to agree on steps that one could take and that you both would advocate?
So everybody heard him, right? As to your first point, we can write all the letters we want and it's not going to happen. I don't disagree that it's still worth writing those letters. But it's funny, right before I came here, I was working on an op-ed to the students who will be marching on Friday. And I was thinking about, we've put all the emphasis now on systemic change. And a lot of people are using it as an excuse not to make personal change. Like, why would I bother when this is a problem of corporations and countries? As if corporations and countries weren't, first of all, subservient to the population. You know, corporations sell us things. When we stop buying those things, they have to change what they sell. I met so many farmers who've told me, I grow what people eat. You know, it's like that simple. When people want to eat something different, I'll grow something different, but don't blame me for growing what people want to eat. We all look aghast at the images of the Amazon. 91% of the burning is for animal agriculture. If you could imagine a worldwide boycott of beef, I can promise you a completely preserved Amazon. It's exactly that simple, but it's also exactly that fraught, because it's as naive to imagine that everybody's going to stop eating beef as it is to imagine your politician reading a letter and saying, hey, that's a nifty idea, gas tax, let's do that. So we need both. We need systemic change and we need change among individuals. And they can work in a kind of reinforcing feedback loop. You know, as governments have ways of making it easier for individuals to make good choices, and individuals have ways of nudging governments to pass good legislation. The problem is we have a ticking clock. I'm not sure that marches and speeches and op-eds, for that matter, are going to get us where we need to be in the amount of time that we have, given the slowness of politics and the leaders that we have. So I think it would be very powerful to have very broad collective acts of, call them whatever you want, rebellion or preservation. If we could have a nationwide boycott of beef for a month, then you would see things start to happen. As to your second question, were Ben Shapiro and I able to agree on anything? You should listen to the thing, or you can watch it. It's available wherever fine podcasts are sold, are presented. At the end, he said, I will try to refrain from animal products for breakfast and lunch. And I said, you'll try? Like, I'll try a lot of things. I can imagine a lot of things. Will you actually do it? And he said, I'll do it. And he said, I'll tell my listeners to do the same thing. So he's coming from a particular perspective, which is he doesn't want the government telling him what to do when it comes to climate change. That's a conservative perspective. That doesn't mean that conservatives don't care about the environment every bit as much as we do. It doesn't mean they don't love their children and grandchildren every bit as much as we do. It means they have a different posture toward how to correct these problems. And what I said to him is, I can respect that that's your posture, but then you have a special responsibility to act on what you say. If you're going to say, this is not a problem for the government to interfere with my life, I'll take care of it, then you really have to take care of it. It's not enough to say, I can imagine eating a little bit differently. You have to do it. And I was really impressed by his willingness to have that conversation and to say the things that he said. I doubt he'll do it, but I doubt I'll do it. I doubt any of us will do it.
Do you ever think of attacking this via a novel as opposed to a nonfiction book?
You know, I didn't really. I wouldn't know how to do that. I fear that it would come out corny and manipulative and transparent. Maybe other people can do it. I hope other people can do it. I think the central problem of climate change is one of storytelling and having a conversation that reveals how much we agree instead of how much we disagree. It's funny, I was giving this another talk when I was away, and at the end, in the question and answer session, a woman stood up and said, you know, you've been talking a lot about food, but don't you think you should talk about fashion? Because the fashion industry, and like a t-shirt involves this carbon footprint, which is actually even greater than a hamburger, and And inside I was thinking, oh, come on, give me a break. Like, give me a break. First of all, and it's funny to hear myself say this because it's exactly what I'm afraid everybody else will say. Oh, shit, I have to think about that too? Like, and then secondly, I'm sure you're wrong. Like, let me give you some stats to counter your stats. And then I thought, why would we do that? What an unproductive way to spend our time. Like, this person is coming from the same place that I'm coming from, which is like, we need to do something right now. We need to start acting in accordance with our values and in accordance with the situation. And so I just said, like, I want to learn more about that. Like, that sounds like something that I would care about. And I'm willing to put another thing on my list of cares, you know? I've been willing to be the beneficiary of all of these things that have caused climate change. I was never complaining when I got to live in a big house, when I got to drive a car whenever I wanted, when I got to fly wherever I wanted, whenever I wanted, when I got to eat whatever I wanted. So who would I be to complain now when I'm being asked what is relatively very little compared to both what I've been given and compared to the scale of the problem?
Hi. First off, thank you so much for coming. This is the greatest opportunity ever. So I just wanted to say a few things. After finishing your nonfiction books or your fiction books in high school and now moving on to Eating Animals, which I think was your first nonfiction book, I really resonated with your on and off vegetarianism, veganism, this and that in high school and throughout, just not being able to commit to it. And after having been, I think I'm like halfway through right now, I've committed fully to vegetarianism, especially this is my first year at Drexel University for environmental engineering, actually. And I've committed fully to vegetarianism. And since then, I've come across a lot of people who have agreed, but had that same sort of lax, like, I'm not really going to do anything about it, or people who just refuse to accept that that's their responsibility. And it makes me a little bit emotionally charged. As a writer myself, like, where would you say I should direct that energy instead of maybe trying to, like, pretentiously correct them or, you know, et cetera?
Well, you were saying it was a journey for yourself, right? So maybe share the journey rather than the destination. You know, I find that when people tell me about their ethical accomplishments, I just don't like them, you know? And weirdly, I have this totally unreasonable response of, well, I'm going to go do a little bit of the opposite because I find you very annoying. When people share with me their challenges, when they say things to me like, man, I've been trying to fly less because Well, because I've been reading the same stuff you've been reading, and because I know what everybody knows. And I find it really hard because flying is good. Like, seeing other parts of the world is not only pleasurable, it feels like an ethical good to, like, have my perspective expanded and to see how other people live. And I don't know how to do it. And what I've started with is flying, not flying for vacations, but I still fly for work, and that kind of feels like a cop-out. But I don't know. What do you think? I find that that kind of conversation really inspires people and, like, brings them in, because we all have struggles to share. Very few of us have perfection to share. So maybe, first of all, not making the other person the referent of the conversation, but making yourself the referent, and beginning with, like, humility and how an acknowledgement that these things can be hard and that it's really great to try. You know, you described yourself now as, I can't remember how you put it, you're fully vegetarian, is that what you said? In a way, I would almost discourage you from describing yourself that way, because somebody who's fully vegetarian is set up to fail. Like, you're either fully or you're not fully. It's like someone is pregnant or they're not pregnant. There's no in between. You might describe yourself instead as being, like, fully committed to trying to not to eat meat, which is how I would describe myself. I earlier described myself as a vegetarian, and I sort of regret it now that I'm thinking about it. It is an accurate description for what I do, but it's not necessarily an accurate description of my experience of what I do, because, as I said, I'm tempted to eat meat all the time. So why not just admit that I'm tempted to eat meat and that it's a process, and that, you know, when I sit down for a meal now, I don't really consider eating meat, but it does take, it's not effortless. It does take a little something to make that decision every time. Simply admitting that something is difficult makes that thing less difficult. So that might be one approach.
You referenced Roosevelt during World War II, for kind of bringing the country together, and my family used to talk about it. And I felt after 9/11 that would be a great time to bring the country together, sort of against fossil fuels. it didn't happen. I was wondering, do you think there are any politicians now that could bring us together with this urgent message? I think it's the time for it.
I don't. But I'm not sure that doesn't leave me hopeless. I think Greta Thunberg has done an excellent job of bringing people together.
Yes.
She is. And it may be that we are in a place now where we need to hear it from a child rather than an adult, that we've become so politicized in a zero-sum game kind of way, where everybody must be scoring a point at somebody else's expense with every move. I can only tell you that my experience, having had a fair number of these conversations, I was in a very small city called Hickory, North Carolina. Has anybody ever been there or heard of it? So I was there just like a week ago, and I was speaking at a Christian college in a very conservative community. And my guess, I didn't ask, so I don't know, but my guess is the great majority of the campus is Republican. I had no problem talking. No, I had no more difficult a time speaking with those students than I would if I went to the Berkeley campus. They don't care less about these things. They don't deny the science at all. The first thing I asked when I took the stage was, how many people in this room believe that the earth is warming because of human activity? And everybody raised their hand, every single person. So we need to find ways of talking about this, as Roosevelt did in that fireside chat, that just remind us that we're on the same team. You know, there are not two teams here. One of the things that's very confusing about this war is that it's us against us, not Democrats versus Republicans, but us against some of our instincts and habits. which makes it much more difficult. It's easy to vilify somebody else. It's hard to have an honest confrontation with yourself. So we need better ways of talking about that, that reveal that we're in this together.
I think part of the issue, as you describe it, is that we have competing values, because when we do fly to Africa or other countries, I mean, we help those people. We learn about them. And so I guess that's the question, really, is how do we reconcile those competing values?
Well, if we eliminated all flying that wasn't to help people, then we'd save the planet. I mean, that would be great. The fact is that that's not what most flying is, and it's most eating is not the Thanksgiving dinner. You know, most meat eating is like the crappy sandwich that you don't even like, but you get it because you had it yesterday. That's it. If people only unlimited, it's actually kind of interesting experiment, thought experiment to conduct. Think about all the times you really enjoy meat, like really enjoy it, not just like it's tasty, like eating a bag of Cheetos is tasty, but like you really enjoy it. And you could enjoy it in a culinary way, or you could enjoy it in a psychological way. So include, when you go to that very special restaurant, include religious occasions, include holiday meals, include family gatherings. How many meals do you think that would comprise in the course of a year? If you were being really honest, really rigorous with that, My guess is it's less than 30. So let's save those meals. Like, eat meat at those meals, by all means. And let's stop eating it when we don't really value it. If we just did that, that would accomplish more than I'm proposing, you know, with this book, which when you read it might feel like a strain or might feel even a bit radical. But if by your own definition, not somebody else's, this is when it doesn't really matter to me. If we could just eliminate that. And travel, we could try the same thing. Like, so different people are different. Some people have a much harder time eating less meat than I do. And some people have a much easier time flying less than I do. That for me is a tough one. But, you know, if I were forced to really be honest with myself and to confront myself about when does flying feel so good that it's justified, when does it give me something that's so good that it's necessary? And could I even still limit the number of flights that I take? Like, instead of, do I need to fly both in the spring and winter vacations, or could I just do one? Or could I combine two trips to make it so that I'm only flying once? I think it's a little bit like making a plan. When we live in our heads, everything gets blurry and ambiguous, and we don't end up acting all that much. But when we concretize things and put them on paper and say, like, here are the trips that I was thinking about taking this year. This one, man, that's a really great one. I can't mess around with that. This one, do I really have to do it? I don't know. We could also take a train to Montreal. That would be pretty fun, you know. So I think it's really, really helpful to put things on paper, to look at them in front of you, and to talk about them with somebody else.
Hi, thanks for being here. It's very eye-opening. Especially to someone who was a butcher for 30 years of his life. Feel a little guilty after that meat is murder comment, I grew up in a family business. We were just in Hyde Park yesterday, actually, looking at the FDR Library. FDR Library and everything. Mm. It was the first time, and there has never been anyone like him. I don't think there will ever be a politician like him. But that's not my question. So what do you think about the advent of fake meat, things like that? Is that good?
What do I think about the advent of fake meat? So I think that meat is fake meat. You know, is every single turkey that's sold in the United States was the product of artificial insemination. Every single turkey that's sold in the United States is the product of artificial insemination, because they've been bred to have bodies too big to have sex. Is that real meat? I mean, is that real meat? Is the meat of animals that require antibiotics to stay alive, is that real meat? So plant-based meat, like Beyond Burgers and Impossible Burgers, I think that they are going to be a big part of the solution. I think eating more vegetables and other natural foods is going to be probably a larger part of the solution. But certainly for things like fast food restaurants, there is just no argument. There's no argument in the world for eating like a beef Whopper at Burger King rather than an Impossible Whopper at Burger King. The Impossible Whopper requires 99% less water, 93% less land, and produces 90% fewer greenhouse gas emissions. That's just a huge difference, and it's an easy place to start. And a lot of people eat a lot of fast food. About a third of Americans eat in a fast food restaurant at some point in the course of a day. So what I find really inspiring about the move to plant-based meats is the way that it's talked about, and just the realities of how it's being consumed. 90% of people who buy Beyond Burgers in supermarkets also buy meat, which is to say it's not a food just for vegetarians. Almost everybody who's buying it is a meat eater who wants to eat less meat. When KFC released this like vegetarian fried chicken in Atlanta, and they're going to start to roll it out around the country, there were lines around the block for people waiting to get it. And I saw that and I thought, well, it's probably just a bunch of vegetarians, you know. That doesn't necessarily tell me anything. KFC painted the restaurant green that day, and I thought, oh, that's really nice. Because they're not just, it's not just, here's a product that we made so vegetarians won't complain so much. They wanted to really proudly announce it and say, this is a big thing that we're doing and a thing that we're, that is good and that is connected to the environment. And the statement that KFC made that day was, we don't think of this as a food for vegetarians. We think of it as a food for all of the meat eaters who want to reduce their meat consumption. 36% of meat eaters in America say they want to eat less meat. And that is the answer. That is the answer. If you were to ask me, what are the odds that in 10 years half of America will be vegetarian? I would say probably zero. If you were to ask me, what are the odds that in 2 years half of the meals eaten in America will be vegetarian? I would say I think that's going to happen. And it's the same outcome, you know, in terms of the effect on the environment and in terms of the effect on animals and human health. But it's a completely different way of looking at it. One is based in identities and one is based in outcomes. And we have to not be afraid of being hypocritical or being incomplete, or we have to risk like sharing what our actual limits are. That's one of these things about making a plan, is it can be very embarrassing to face your actual limits, to have to say, like, I think I can only fly once less a year. It's a difficult thing to articulate, but it's better to articulate that than to not fly once less a year. And I think as we open up this space where people can, where instead of measuring the distance from perfection, we're measuring the distance from doing nothing. You know, instead of pointing out each other's hypocrisies, we're pointing out each other's accomplishments and saying, that's so awesome. Like, you don't eat meat on Monday? That's great. Like, what a good start. You know, like if we could say to each other and to ourselves, like, what a good start. I think we would not only make great progress, we would feel good. And that's one of the things that is rarely talked about with these changes. We have the impression that we're all going to have to become martyrs and live these diminished lives full of sacrifice. Anyone in this room who has ever acted on a value, said no to something because of another value, knows that it feels really good. And it feels good to just be oneself, you know, to like close the distance between who you are and who you want to be. And I remember what it's like to eat a great steak, and the pleasure of eating the steak ends when I swallow the last bite. There is no more pleasure to be had. If anything, it starts to feel not so good after that. But the pleasure of acting on your values is not as immediate and it's not as primitive as the pleasure of food, but I think it's deeper and it's definitely longer lasting. You know, if you imagine that Philadelphia became the first carbon neutral city in the country, whatever it took, do you think it would be awesome to be a citizen of Philadelphia? Do you think you'd be so incredibly proud to live in Philadelphia and to see people report in the newspapers about how mayors of other cities are trying to learn the lessons of Philadelphia, how people who live in other cities want to be more like the people who live in Philadelphia. You feel so proud. It'd be exhilarating. It'd be really thrilling. You'd still have the 76ers, but it would be... Go Nets. But it would feel really good. And I think that that's another thing that's we have to bring our minds back to whenever we look at this and feel like, oh my God, this is going to be the biggest dragon in human history. It might just be it might be just the opposite. So I think we're out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.